Hello everybody, I'm Jacopo De Toni and this is the FDI Podcast. Developing countries have been busy refining investment promotion strategies to increase their appeal as an investment destination. But does investment promotion really matter to foreign investors? The Trade and Competitiveness Global Practice Division of the World Bank tried to answer these and many other questions in a comprehensive survey among 754 executives of multinational corporations investing in developing countries. Their findings showed that investment promotion agencies, also known as IPAs, still have little influence in the decision-making of foreign investors. Only 43% of the surveyed investors say that IPAs are important or critically important in their decision to invest. The lowest among investment climate factors, including transparency and predictability of public institutions, as well as protection guarantees provided in the host country's laws. The relatively low rating of importance of IPAs, the World Bank survey concludes, does not necessarily suggest that host countries should not strengthen them. The reverse could actually be true, that host countries currently offer poor quality IPA services for investors, which is why investors' perceptions are not very positive. I'm here with Courtney Finger, editor-in-chief of FDI Magazine. Courtney, you've been covering IPA strategies for many years now. So what is your first reactions before these findings?
Well, I can't say I'm overly surprised by the findings. Many, if not most, of the companies that I speak to don't even know what an investment promotion agency is, and oftentimes they just might not even care. Right. I remember once speaking to the CEO of a UK-based SME, and one that had globalized very quickly in a number of years, 50 offices around the world, and he'd never heard of an investment promotion agency, and nor his team had never even dealt with one in any of the 50 countries in which they had expanded. A lot of those countries they expanded in were in the developing world. And it was a real shame, I thought, because once I told him about some of the things that IPAs do, he was quite intrigued. So his company really could have benefited from some help and assistance as they entered these markets. And I think that that story is fairly typical. So I think that IPAs do have a battle for relevancy sometimes. And they really need to work hard to make the companies aware, not just of the attributes and the strengths of their locations, but also about themselves, their organizations, and the services that they can offer. I think, as the study says, a big problem is actually the quality of those services. So there's partly an issue of awareness of what IPAs can do, but then there's the quality. And it's not unique to developing countries as well. You have good IPAs and bad IPAs all around the world. And really, the point is, are the services streamlined? Are they efficient? Are they helpful? And therefore, are they valuable to a company as they move into that market? And this is really where the focus needs to be. And every place now is declaring that they're a one-stop shop, for example. But in the majority of cases, it's not. It's, and that's not a successful IPA really should be this one-stop shop to help facilitate everything to do with the investment and make sure that it's as easy as possible. I know that investment promotion officials work extremely hard, but I think there's a lot more work that could be done in adding that value that they could in terms of facilitating investment.
Right. So basically, this World Bank survey was a very comprehensive survey, and their findings go much beyond the role of IPAs, but they asked these executives about their what are the most important factors in their decision making when it comes to actually find the right location for their investment. Before hearing from the IPAs themselves, let's hear what Anabel Gonzalez, who is a senior director with the World Bank and oversaw this whole survey, what she told me in Vienna just a couple of weeks ago.
As regards the survey, I think that there are several highlights. The first one is the importance, of course, that a foreign direct investment as a mechanism for financing in developing countries. It is clear that official development assistance and remittances are, of course, very small if you compare them to investment flows, and that developing countries need private investment to be able to meet the sustainable development goals. So that I think is something that comes out very clearly. Second point is that there are different drivers for investment, but certainly macroeconomic stability and a business climate that is favorable to investment come up on the list. We saw from the report, investment from developing countries into developing countries has been increasing, and we also find out that investors from developing countries seem to be more resilient in terms of investing in developing countries, which may be because they themselves are more used to managing certain levels of uncertainty. This resilience of investors coming from developing countries into other developing countries is something of interest, because it seems to be that the risk level that these investors are willing to tolerate is a bit higher than more sort of established investors from developed countries, which I think should be interpreted not as, you know, as a signal that there's not a need for a reform agenda to continue, on the contrary, but that there is it's worth pursuing investors from developing countries, particularly when you're thinking about some destinations, fragile and conflict states that may be very challenging and where there's the level of risk is very high. There may be options for pursuing investors from developing countries as a means of having first movers into the country, and that is something that I think is important from the perspective of developing countries.
So, Courtney, a few interesting points here. What can be the main takeaways from these findings for policymakers involved in the design of investment promotion strategies?
Well, again, I would reiterate the point of making sure that the services are top-notch and adding value. I think the trend of developing countries investing into other developing countries is very clear and will only continue to accelerate. And that is helpful in the sense that those companies from developing markets are more, they can handle more risk, they're more used to it, but they still need the same services. So I think that should not lend itself to complacency in terms of making the investment environment as simple and seamless as possible. It, just because companies can take on more risk doesn't mean that they necessarily want to or that the investment process should be complicated. So I think that really the message to draw from all of it is that investment promotion agencies have an important role to play in facilitating investment, but they should also see themselves as advocates for continual improvements in their investment environments in order to attract investors, not just from other developing countries, but from advanced markets as well, and to make their investment offer as strong as possible.
Right. So let's hear from the IPA themselves. As mentioned, this survey was presented in Vienna in an event where the World Bank invited many IPAs from all over the globe. And one major case and one case of great interest was the case of Ethiopia. Ethiopia, a country that to many has been known for many years for mostly for famines and deprivation, but in fact, it has quietly pulled itself out of this big troubles and become a pretty interesting hotspot for a specific type of foreign investment, specifically labor-intensive manufacturing. So I met with Dr. Kebe Okubai, who is a special advisor to the Prime Minister in Ethiopia and also in charge of designing investment promotion strategies in the country.
We are primarily focused on agriculture and manufacturing. In this manufacturing sector, the prime focus is on light manufacturing. When we say light manufacturing, these are industries that are labor intensive, mainly for exporting market, and as well as mostly linked with agriculture. So within this, we have like apparel and textile is important for two reasons. As we are a newly industrializing nation, that is a very good learning plan. And it's also a growing industry. It's a $1.2 trillion industry. And you can create millions of jobs with apparel and textiles. So with this basic approach, the focus has been to attract on investors, and we had to start with questions. What are the binding constraints for FDI? When we say this, it means we have to look at existing investors, what issues they face. For instance, they face power quality issues. They face issues related with customs clearance. They also face problems with infrastructure and utilities outside energy as well. So one basic key direction we have put is focusing on building industrial parks so that we make sure that the binding constraints will be addressed with this framework.
And actually, Ethiopia has been a quite successful case in terms of attracting foreign investment. Last year, just greenfield FDI reached record level of 6.7 billion, according to the figures of our database, FDI markets. As the country is capitalizing in a way on macroeconomic and political stability, but also on the infrastructure development has been delivered over the few year, the last few years by Chinese contractors. And also this this investment promotion strategy is very sort of seems to be very targeted and very specific in terms of setting up industrial parks equipped for specific industries like apparel and textile, following in the footsteps of other countries that have been very successful in this, like for example Vietnam. And another country that seems to be willing in a way to replicate the success of Ethiopia is now Myanmar, who is a country obviously that is experiencing a very different political situation. The country is transitioning towards democracy after many years of military dictatorship, but is also very rich in natural resources like natural gas, for example, but is also trying to leverage its big and deep pool of labor force, pretty convenient labor force to the eyes of foreign investors, to attract growing inflows of FDI. So I spoke to Mr. O Ning, who is the head of the investment promotion agency there in Myanmar.
Government has already claimed that our promoter sector will be number one manufacturing sector because we want to have more job opportunities for the people of Myanmar. So therefore, we are prioritizing the manufacturing sector as our one of the prioritized sectors for investment. And also we are promoting investment infrastructure development because Myanmar's infrastructure is still very weak. We do need a lot of investment, and government itself cannot invest sufficiently to the infrastructure sector. So therefore we need some private investment in the infrastructure. Therefore infrastructure has become another priority of investment promotion. Thirdly, agriculture, because Myanmar's economy is based on agriculture. So therefore, for us, agriculture is extremely important, not only for the investment, but also for poverty alleviation and rural development and other issues. So the agriculture is one of the top priorities.
So I think Myanmar is interesting for a couple of reasons here. Definitely for their idea again to focus on labor intensive manufacturing. But before getting to that, I think it's also interesting for the fact that, again, going back to the survey that emphasizes the importance or the predictability of a regulatory framework, Myanmar, when the country actually got a first ever democratic government last year, many people expected the country to have an immediate investment boom. But this didn't happen, right? Because investors were still sort of in a wait-and-see mode because they felt things maybe get better, but they just wanted to have clear in mind what would be the policy of a democratic government as opposed to the investment promotion strategies of the military junta that was in charge until just a couple of years ago. But currently, going back to manufacturing, so obviously these countries, they got good reasons to focus on labor-intensive manufacturing. But let me be a bit provocative here. In the long run, does it really make sense in the era of automation to focus on big labor-intensive manufacturing?
Well, in the long term, maybe not. But I think it has a sense in the short term because these are countries that have urgent job creation needs today. Right. And in many developing countries, they can't necessarily afford to skip a step and go straight to automation. The skills aren't there, the technology's not there, and that's not where they're at in terms of their workforce or their economy. So I think there's clearly always going to be a role for manufacturing. It's just that how things are manufactured are going to change. So the best thing countries at an early stage of development, the best thing they can do is go ahead and get involved in the manufacturing value chain. So go ahead and attract the projects now, create those jobs, and hope that they can then evolve with the manufacturing processes as those evolve. And that really would come through proper worker training.
Right. And actually, there is also clear evidence in different countries that this, let's say, low added value manufacturing still through linkages with local suppliers and a local supply chain that can help the development of the level of complexity of a host economy. And this was the case, for example, there were a couple of studies on this on Turkey, that Turkey has been very successful in the last 20, 30 years in attracting FDI and translating this FDI into an opportunity for local industry to evolve and develop. And today there is, for example, very advanced aerospace industry in Turkey.
That's right. I think it is that important step that necessarily can't be skipped, essentially.
Right. On the other hand, there are countries that definitely lack the market size and the labor force of Ethiopia or Myanmar or Turkey. And so smaller countries have to find other elements of appeal to come up with a solid investment proposition. One of these countries is Tunisia, which is an interesting country because now economic growth is sort of picking up 6 years after the Arab Spring. And I met with Khalil Labidi, who is the head of FIPA, which is the Tunisia Investment Promotion Strategy. And this is what he said.
In industry, we are working now to implement foreign companies. We have 67 companies working in car components, providing all OMEs all over the world. And we have a new industry of aeronautics with 80 company working for Airbus. And now the new sector, communication, because in Tunisia we have a very high level of unemployment with high-skilled persons. We're still working with France, Italy and Germany as the three main countries, but now we are looking for our continent, which is Africa, because we can be a big hub between Europe and GA2 and America.
Again, I guess here the idea of also from an investment promotion perspective of growing inflows of capital from developing countries. So also a country like Tunisia is now starting to look not exclusively to its European partner, but also to its African partner, with whom probably shares more cultural and trade ties. And it also obviously trying to leverage its position, and this is not an isolated case. It is also the case, for example, of another country, small country, but very strategically located at the heart of the Caucasus region, which is Armenia. And I met there in Vienna with Alexandra Hachaturian, who is the executive director of the Center for Strategic Initiatives that support the government in its investment promotion strategy.
The existing government has, which is in power, basically in office, slightly more than 1 year. The policy that we have approached is this as a country, as a platform policy approach. Basically, our market is small for a lot of investors, but we're located in a very interesting geographic area where we're bordering with Iran and we're a member of Eurasian Economic Union. And we propose ourselves not only as access to Armenian market, but more as access to Iranian market and also the market of Eurasian Economic Union. So in terms of, for instance, doing business in Eurasian Economic Union, I think Armenia is in a very, very favorable position, both in terms of existing legislation, also the doing business rankings, etc. This year we have improved our ranking on Global Competitiveness Index and its government program to actually reach a top 20 in the doing business in the next 5 years. And our banking system is very good. It's very internationally connected, and we have big banks operating in the country. So, and on top of that, what we create sort of different other infrastructure and regulatory frameworks necessary for accessing to those markets. For instance, in case of Iran, what we do, we are going to open a free economic zone on the border with Iran. So basically, that zone and the distance between that zone and Iran is going to be just one bridge that you have to cross in customs clearance. So a lot of companies that want to access Iranian market, but for some reason they don't want to keep their assets in Iran, they can keep their assets on the border with Iran in Armenia which is, as I said, I think, if I remember correctly, number 38 on doing business. We don't have capital repatriation restriction. We don't have money transfer restriction. We have very good banking system, very liberal jurisdiction. With the problems, of course, but at least comparably, we're in a very favorable position. Also, the market that can give you access, a non-tariff regulation reaching to Eurasian Economic Union, also a jurisdiction that has a GSP plus with European Union and United States, also a jurisdiction that is going to enter, I hope, in the next few months, a special treaty with the European Union. So we are playing as a connector, as a gateway to different jurisdictions, basically Eurasian Economic Union, which is 180 million market, and Iran, which is 80 million market. So through Armenia, you can access in different ways 260 million market, which is a very good opportunity for us.
Courtney, you know the case of Armenia pretty well. So how successful has been Armenia in establishing itself as a connector, as Mr. Khachaturian says?
Well, in terms of the fundamentals, it's all there. It's in place, and it works in the sense of the government has been proactive in establishing trade relations and therefore putting the country in the position to be a gateway destination. So that play has a lot of upside and makes a lot of sense. I think the case of the access to Iran is particularly interesting because that's a market that will be opening up that would probably interest a lot of companies but make them nervous at the same time. So Armenia presents an opportunity to go to a place that Western companies, for example, might feel more comfortable with and access an exciting new market. I think where Armenia suffers is in awareness of these attributes that they have. It has a quite low profile internationally and on the investment scene. So I'm not sure it's at that stage where it's just front of mind. So I think in terms of their role as a connector, they've got the goods and now they have to sell it.
Which in a way goes back to the idea of for investment promotion agency to become more relevant, to reach out, to be more proactive in terms of reaching out to investors and spread the word about what can be the opportunity for them to be in a country like Armenia or Tunisia.
Absolutely. I actually spoke with a relatively new head of the Development Foundation of Armenia recently, and that's the investment agency for the country, and they are now looking to hire reps, dozens of reps internationally to represent Armenia in key markets around the world. And that's something a lot of agencies have had for a long time, so they're now at least doing that. And I think a profile-raising awareness international campaigns would also be valuable for them.
Right. Well, I mean, a pretty different case is the case of commodity-rich countries. These countries, like two specific countries that I got in touch with, Kazakhstan and Mongolia, they saw incredibly high inflows of foreign investment at the height of the commodity boom between, let's say, 2009 and 2013. Once the commodity boom was over, they really struggled in terms of restructuring their economies, in terms of keeping shoring up economic growth and finding any value beyond the commodity sector. So diversification has become sort of the mantra for most of this country. So before addressing some point specifically, let's hear what Erlan Khairov, who is the Vice Minister for Investments and Development of Kazakhstan, told me there in Vienna.
We worked more than 6 years, I think, with the OECD. We changed the legislation, everything. Maybe you know that in Kazakhstan you can visit without any visa. So it's one of the, I think, our victory, what we achieved. And it was in all sectors, in different sectors. Court system, taxation, everywhere we changed the legislation because for us it's mostly important to prepare the best investment climate in the region. So in this year, we became the member of the OECD Investment Committee. And we understand that is our good result, that our investment climate on the same standards like the OECD countries.
I think that Kazakhstan is an interesting example because they actually have been pretty successful in liberalizing their investment, their business environment. This issue with visas, it may sound kind of not pointless, but not that important from a European perspective, but it's actually really a unique element in a region like Central Asia, where getting a visa also for big four investors, let's say in the oil sector or in the mining sector, has always been sort of tricky. And actually, the improvement of the Kazakh business environment go beyond visas. They are actually been working very closely with, again, as you mentioned, the OECD, but also the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development and other international institutions. So that in a way their international status, their international profile has been rising over the years, and this makes foreign investors more sort of confident and comfortable in doing business there in Kazakhstan, even though it remains a very tricky business environment for different elements. And that they have been successful only to a certain extent in terms of diversifying the economy. There is still much work to be done in terms of developing an industrial base, which historically Kazakhstan has never had, and developing infrastructure. This is a huge country with only 20 million people, so infrastructure is key, but it's not very easy for them to bring on board private investors because, for example, from a public-private partnership perspective, the economic, the business model is not really there, because maybe if you think of a road connection, maybe there is just very little traffic going on that road, even though that little traffic is very important for the country. But from a concessional perspective, there is probably little money to be done there. A different case is Mongolia. Mongolia, again, experienced this incredibly booming FDI inflows at the height of the commodity boom, but really struggled to reform its business environment. So let's hear what Enkha Bayar Namildorj, senior advisor to the prime minister, told me.
And nowadays, well, most of the FDI in the mining sector. And we have many livestock, more than 60 million animals. And also we have very huge export potential and all to neighbors. So we are inviting foreign investors in the agriculture sector, usually mostly in the food processing sector. Also, one of the priority, it's regarding one belt, one road. We have a government plan for the named of the development. It's all case in Mongolia, we call it development road project, how to connect Russia and China by the different of type of roads, railways and air routes. So we're inviting also foreign investors to work together to implement these projects. And recently we have Mongolian and the Russian side together discussed how to implement this plan.
So, Courtney, also looking at the experience of countries all over the world, how important can be foreign investment for the diversification of these commodity-rich economies?
Well, I think FDI is essential for that, and it's a quicker and sure way to diversification, I think, than trying to do it organically. It's difficult to do because if the economy and therefore the workforce has all been geared towards commodities and extractive industries, then they might not be so easily geared up to do other things. But I think it's essential. I'm hard pressed to think of a situation where an economy was able to successfully diversify without opening up and bringing in foreign investment to do it. I mean, we publish a ranking every year called the FDI Diversification Index, and we do one specifically for commodity economies, and Russia tops our index for that. So for all its difficulties and problems in investment environment and the economy, what that suggests is actually Russia's mix of FDI sectors is actually quite well diversified, and therefore that presents maybe a model for other commodity economies to look at.
Right, I think it brings to my mind an example of Chile. Chile is also obviously the largest producer, the world's largest producer of copper. But over the years, they've always been very successful in diversifying the economy, also with the help of foreign investment. For example, in the infrastructure sector, there are like Canadian pension funds are famous to be involved in the Chilean infrastructure, in Chilean concessions. But this also, I guess, also highlights the importance of reforms in the business environment in terms of, for example, if you look at PPPs, investors generally tend to refrain from engaging with PPPs unless the whole legislation package is there, unless their risks are properly hedged by the legislation and through other channels. So again, and also, if I may go back to the idea of Mongolia, for example, it's true that they got like this huge stock of animals and they grow in the wild, so they have a huge competitive advantage towards industrial livestock. But at the same time, Mongolia for many years has failed to meet any international standards that could allow this meat processing industry to export its products. So again, this probably goes back to the idea of reforming the business environment, creating adjusting standards to international level. So as a final remark to wrap it up, Courtney, and going back to the idea of to the role of IPAs. So what would you say? How can investment promotion agency become more relevant in the promotion of their countries?
Well, in short, it operates at a few levels. One, at the broadest level, is to have smart strategies for promotion and awareness of what they offer. The second layer is properly understanding what their strengths are and which sectors they could be competitive in, and therefore really carefully targeting exactly the right companies in those sectors and going to the companies with a precise opportunity, not just doing a brochure that says what attributes there are. Think how companies think and go to them with a very specific market opportunity, which requires targeting the companies properly and understanding the companies and their strategies. And of course, the way to do this is through market intelligence and data. But the fundamental thing, which has come up time and time again in our conversation, is the fundamentals, which is doing everything possible to make the business environment, the legislation, the regulation, everything as FDI friendly as possible.
Right. All right. Well, Courtney, thank you very much for these comments and for being on the show today. Thanks, everybody, for listening. You can find the FDI podcast on fdiintelligence.com/podcast. or on any other major podcast platforms like Acast or iTunes. Stay tuned. Thanks.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Coriant. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.